Well, good morning, everybody. It's such a pleasure to be here, although it's a little bit sorrowful knowing that this is my last morning with everybody here, but I'm excited for the opportunity. I did want to say a couple of special things right at the very beginning. First of all, I wanted to introduce to you, for those of you who don't know them, Peter and Janine Garcia right over here. Peter and Janine, can you guys just stand up for a minute? Peter and Janine, my wife Inga-Lil and I, we've known them for more than 20 years, way back in Southern California, where they were just part of some home Bible studies and young churches that we had together, and we've just had such a warm relationship with them over the years. And they have an itinerant worship music, just serve the Lord ministry. And if you're not acquainted with them, they call their ministry Deep Water, and you can get in touch with them. And I just think they're great people that some of you people should get to know. So God bless you, Peter and Janine. I also want to say something to Troy. Troy, I was so excited about getting back into pastoral ministry until I heard that message. But it's true, brother, it's true, and thank you for that. I mean, it's really something that everybody has to deal with. And, you know, it is a different thing for us, because I'll be honest with you, it is a lot easier to be a Bible college director than it is to be the pastor of a church. And I've enjoyed that ease in some ways. I mean, there's other parts of my calling and my job the last 7 years I think has been more difficult. But dealing with that kind of thing that Pastor Troy was speaking to us about, well, this is something that we're moving back into. And we just appreciate your prayers and your good wishes towards us. It's an exciting time that we have in front of us in Santa Barbara. We still got some things to wrap up in Europe. We won't be moving to California for good until the first week of July. But we're excited about what God has in front of us. Turn in your Bibles, if you would, to 2 Kings chapter 7. 2 Kings chapter 7. I think Pastor Sandy just has a way of coming up with the most wonderful themes for his conferences. And this one has been a good one, hasn't it? The battles of the Lord and the battles of ministry. And today I want to talk to you about a different kind of battle. It's the battle of the siege of Samaria. Now, do you know what a siege is? A siege is very different than the other kinds of battles that we've been talking about during this time. The other kinds of battles we've been talking about is where you have pitched armies on a field. And there's swords flashing, and there's spears thrusting, and there's arrows being shot. And there's great armies moving against one another with horses and chariots and different detachments and divisions of soldiers. They're great cataclysmic events where a lot of blood is shed, and things get decided right then on one afternoon on the field of battle. They're great dramatic affairs. And then there's a different kind of battle, a siege. Sieges were very common in the ancient world, and you know the whole idea behind a siege, don't you? An army would surround a walled city, and the army would basically say, nothing goes into that city, and nothing comes out of that city, and we're going to starve them out. Oh, sure, occasionally they'd launch some arrows or maybe a catapult if they were very sophisticated over the walls, but typically, the walled defenses of a city were significant enough to discourage a front-on attack. Thus, the siege was developed as a cruel but effective strategy. An effective siege could take years to happen, and there was no one big dramatic battle. There was no great afternoon on which the blood was shed and the issue was decided. No, in siege warfare, you died by drips. You died a little bit every day in a battle that never seemed to end. And it was a great waiting game. It was a waiting game between those on the outside of the walls and those on the inside of the walls. And who would win the waiting game in a battle that seemed to go on forever? Some of the battles we fight in our churches are a lot more like sieges than they are like battles that are finished in one afternoon, aren't they? We feel like we die by drips. We wish it could be one big dramatic battle. We wish we could get all of those critics, All of those naysayers, all of those detractors, all of those people who want to try to run us and turn us in ministry and say, let's get it together. Let's have a rumble right now together in the sanctuary one afternoon. Somebody's walking out of this room and somebody's not. Come on, Pastor, you've hungered for that in your heart, haven't you? Oh, but instead, the siege, a little bit is taken out of you day by day. And the worst thing about a siege is you feel like there's no hope. Every day you woke up, you look over the walls, and the army is still there. You feel like there's no answer to the problem, and it's going to forever go on this way, declining, 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 drip, 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 until what? Until you die and you're conquered. That's the tough reality of a siege. And that's exactly where the northern kingdom of Israel was when we come to 2 Kings chapter 7. Now, we know this from chapter 6, that Syria once again had attacked Samaria. And that was the capital city of the northern kingdom of Israel. And under the siege, the people of the city of Samaria began to starve. It got so bad, and again we know this from 2 Kings chapter 6, it got so bad that a donkey's head was sold for 16 months of wages. That's how much it would cost you to buy a donkey's head to eat, not for decoration, but to eat. It got so bad that a cup of dove poop was sold for more than 1 month's wages. It got so bad that mothers were eating their own children. And it got so bad that that wicked king, the man we saw last night, Jehoram, he blamed the prophet Elisha and he demanded that the prophet fix the problem. Verse 1, 2 Kings chapter 7. Then Elisha said, this is the response of Elisha to the wicked king Jehoram, who's demanding you, Elisha, you do something about our problem. Verse 1 again, then Elisha said, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow about this time, a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria. Now you understand what he's saying. He's saying, tomorrow, don't worry about donkey heads and cups of dove poop. Tomorrow, there's going to be wheat, there's going to be barley, and it's going to be sold at reasonable prices. Tomorrow, not 10 weeks from now, tomorrow. The response, so an officer on whose hand the king leaned answered the man of God and said, look, if the Lord would make windows in heaven, could this thing be? And he said, this is what Elisha said back to him, in fact, you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it. Now look, pastor, minister, Christian worker, if you find yourself now thinking in the past, maybe at the present, maybe sometime in the future, in the midst of a siege, I think that there's many, many things that you should hear. I think that you should reference the message that Pastor Troy just shared with us. That's certainly one great aspect of a siege, dealing with those assaults of criticism that come against you. But actually, life under siege time is very complex, isn't it? And there's no way I could deal with how to deal with it in one message. So I'm going to emphasize one particular key from 2 Kings chapter 7 on how to get you through siege time. And here's that one key. I'll put it in one word. Faith. Faith. Trusting God. You see, this is what happened. Elisha came to Jehoram and he said, Jehoram, even though you are blaming me, could you imagine? Could you imagine the wicked king of Israel blaming the godly prophet for the calamity that had come upon the city of Samaria? And he said, no, even though I know you're blaming me, God has a word for you. Hear the word of the Lord. I'm surprised that God had a word for this wicked king at all. Would not have been fully within God's rights to simply say, I don't have anything to say to this man. Elisha, turn your back on him and walk away. I'll provide for you, Elisha. I'll provide for my remnant wherever I please to, but have nothing to do with this wicked son of Ahab and Jezebel. But he didn't do that. God had a word for a man even in the midst of his wickedness. And I think about that. I think about it not because I have any prophetic insight, not because I'm going to point a finger or shoot an arrow and see where it goes. I say it simply because of the law of averages. That there have to be a few people in this room right now this morning, and you are really resisting God. You have really dug your heels in against him. You're here at this conference acting as if you want the Lord to speak to you, but you've done it. I know I've done it before in my spiritual life. It's like you do this, Lord, please speak to me. You know what I mean? And I'm here to tell you right now this morning that even if you are rejecting God right now, he has a word for you. Isn't that wonderful? How gracious of our God to not give us what we deserve, but to say, no, I'll speak to you even when you're being that stubborn. And so what did Elisha say? Verse 1, he said, tomorrow about this time, a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria. God's promise through Elijah was that in 24 hours, the economic situation in Samaria would be completely reversed. Instead of scarcity, there would be such an abundance that food prices would radically drop in the city. Because the gate was the place of the marketplace as well as the local court of justice. Now, I do want you to know something, and this is just sort of an aside. By the standards of that time, the prices he listed were not exactly cheap. It wasn't going to be a great bargain time at the gate, but there would be something instead of nothing. And by the next day, the conditions would be so improved that you could get good products at a reasonable price, even if it wasn't the best price. Now, what was the response of the king's officer who stood next to Jehoram when he heard Elisha utter these words? Verse 2 says that the officer said, look, even if the Lord would make windows in heaven, could this thing be? The king's officer doubted the prophecy, and his doubt was based on several faulty premises. And I really want to explore this for a moment, because you may think that your doubt or your unbelief is logical. Sometimes we defend our doubt as unbelief, as being, listen, I'm just being logical. No, listen. Real faith is the most logical thing. And this officer of the king had several faulty premises that he based his unbelief on. First of all, he doubted the power of God. Listen, if God willed it, could not God certainly make windows in heaven and drop down food from the sky for the hungry besieged city of Samaria? If God wanted to do it, couldn't he do it? Couldn't he send forth angels with care packages? Couldn't he open up a window or a door in heaven and just start piling down food? There's food in heaven. God could send down as much as he wants to. And so he doubted the power of God. If God wanted to do so, he certainly could. Secondly, he doubted the creativity of God. In the mind of the king's officer, the way food could come to the city was from above, because the city was completely surrounded by a hostile, besieging army. He had no idea that God could bring provision in a completely unexpected way. Isn't that how it often works with our unbelief? You see, we know that God is, we know that God can act, but we only see one way that God can move. And we put all our effort, all our hope, all our expectation on that one way. And when God doesn't come through in that one way, we think he's failed us. The officer looks out. I see a Syrian army all around us. Nothing can come in on the horizontal level. Therefore, God would have to send it vertically from heaven if it's going to come. Oh, yes? My God's a creative God. He can do things in ways I've never expected. He has ways of providing that I've never thought about for a moment. That's one of the reasons why I don't try to figure out God's plan, right? So sometimes I think that when I try to figure out God's plan, that he just checks off the possibilities that I've thought of in my mind. And so I say, no, Lord, I'll make it easy for you, God. I have no idea. I don't even want to think about how you're going to provide in this place. Because God wants to do it in a new, creative way. The third error in the officer's faith was that he doubted the messenger of God. Who was it standing right before him saying these things? It was Elisha the prophet. This man of God who had been used mightily of God both to work miracles and to proclaim forth the word of God. Even though the promise was hard to believe, the king's officer could have and should have believed it because it came from a man with an established track record of reliability. He should have said, listen, that sounds awfully hard to believe, but if this prophet of God, if Elisha tells me it, then I believe it. All in all, the officer here in verse 2 well illustrates the conduct of unbelief. Unbelief dares to question the truthfulness of God's promise itself. Unbelief says it's a new thing and it can't be true. Unbelief says it's a sudden thing and it can't be true. Unbelief says there's no way I can figure out how to accomplish this thing, so it can't be true. Unbelief says there's only one way that God can do his work. And unbelief says even if God does something, it won't be enough. Listen, I think that we have to be sort of harsh with ourselves when it comes to unbelief. I think sometimes we're far too forgiving of ourselves. We're far too forgiving of unbelief that we see in ourselves. Do we not recognize that it is a grievous sin to not believe God? For God to tell us something, straight up, right in front of our face. You read it in the Bible. I mean, there's this biblical promise right there for you. You're not taking it out of context. You're not wrenching it from some place where it doesn't belong to you. No, this is a promise that belongs to the children of God. And you read it, and it's almost as if you hear the serpent whisper in your ear, has God really said? We need to be harsh with ourselves with that kind of unbelief. No, never, never, never in a million years would I look at my Father in heaven and say, I'm not sure if you're telling me the truth. Matter of fact, and I've touched on this point before, it's almost worse when we say we're trying to believe God. Do you know what a disgrace that is? Okay, God, you know, you are so shaky in your trustworthiness that I'm really trying to believe you. Believe me, I am. I'm working, I'm trying to believe you, but I just don't know if I can. What insult! If somebody said that to you, you'd be very insulted. You say, well, what do you mean you're trying to believe me? I mean, either you believe me or you don't. Haven't I given you enough reason to trust me? And of course, God could say that 1,000 times over in our life. No, no, no. We need to be harsh with unbelief in our hearts. We need to say, I'm going to stop trying to believe God, and I'm just simply going to believe him. Because the penalty for unbelief, did you see it right there in verse 2? Elisha answered back to the officer, and he said, in fact, you're going to see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it. Through Elisha, God pronounced a harsh judgment upon the king's doubting officer. He would see the word fulfilled, but he wouldn't benefit from its fulfillment. So what happened? Take a look now, verse 3. This is how this great prophecy of Elisha came to pass. Verse 3, now there were four leprous men at the entrance of the gate. And they said to one another, why are we sitting here until we die? If we say, we'll enter into the city, the famine's in the city, and we'll die there. And if we sit here, we die also. Now therefore, come, let us surrender to the army of the Syrians. If they keep us alive, we shall live. And if they kill us, we'll only die. You got to like that. And they rose at twilight to go to the camp of the Syrians. And when they had come to the outskirts of the Syrian camp, to their surprise, no one was there. Four leprous men hanging out at the entrance of the gate. Verse 3 tells us that they were outside the gate, no doubt because they were not welcome inside the city. If you're a city under siege, last thing you want is four more mouths to feed, right? Especially if they're leprous mouths. Get them out of the city. They don't belong in here. They were outcasts. They were untouchables. And they were just the kind of people that God would use. Now go ahead. I want you to go through your Bible, and I want you to take out all the stories that have to do with poor, afflicted, unqualified men and women being used by God. Take out all of those stories, and what do you got left? A very small book, don't you? Now listen, this is how God moves. Remember the words of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, starting at verse 26. For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't it wonderful to realize that in some extent you're an outcast and you're despised and say, and God can still use me nonetheless. I could be as rejected as a leper and God nevertheless can use me. That's exactly what God was going to do with these four men. And their logic was impeccable. Did you see that in verse 3? Why are we sitting here until we die? And they recognized that they were soon going to die from the famine if they stayed right where they were. They would die probably from the sword if they tried to enter the city. They might die if they went and tried to get some help at the army of the Syrians. You see, if any food became available at the city, they would be last in line to receive it. No. Their chances were much better if they surrendered to the Syrians. And you know, that's something I really want to impress upon you, is that faith is completely logical. What greater logic could there be than trusting the God of the universe? Who loves us, who cares for us, who has declared his love for us over and over again. He's worthy to be trusted. And if we just think through things logically, how often we can cut that fog of despair. You know the fog of despair that comes upon you sometimes in a season of spiritual attack? I felt it. There was a season in my ministry where I would face this fog of overwhelming despair as I would sit in the front row during worship before I was going to get up and preach. And I would just think of what a worthless man I was, and what a sinner I was, and what an unworthy servant of God I was. And I was just convinced I had no business getting up and teaching God's people his word, and that surely I just needed to resign and get out of the ministry. And you can say those words, but even beyond those words, there was just this fog of spiritual darkness. It was like a cloud that would come upon me. And I would sit there and I would think, okay, this is it. I would be absolutely convinced this is my last sermon. This is it. I can't ask anybody else to preach. I mean, nobody else is prepared. I'm the guy this morning, but this is going to be my last sermon. And then God would give me just a little bit of the logic of faith right there. The logic of faith would say, well, if this is going to be my last sermon, I want it to be a good one. And I'd go up there fully convinced, this is it, last message, all right. But listen, I'm going to go out with a good message. And I would get up there and I'd stand behind the pulpit and I'd, all right, let's begin. And you know what? That fog would just clear away. And God would speak to me and he'd speak to his people and be a beautiful thing. But again, that logic of faith. And you know, this is exactly where the lepers were at. Where they're at. There's two ways in front of them. I can stay where I'm at and I can perish, or I can go out and do something and see God do something glorious. And that's exactly what the lepers would do. So in verse 5, it says they had come to the outskirts of the Syrian camp. To their surprise, no one was there. This huge army of the Syrians had surrounded the city of Samaria for months and months. And it was the home, it was the supply center for thousands and thousands of men. And when the lepers came upon it that morning, they discovered an empty army camp. Fully supplied, but just empty. It was as if, and you'll know what I mean, but it was as if the rapture had happened there to that camp of the Syrians. Just everybody was gone. Now those words in the text, to the outskirts of the Syrian camp, imply for us in the original Hebrew that they came not from only to the edge of the camp, but they walked around to the furthermost part of the Syrian camp, the part furthest away from the city. They came to the camp as someone walking from afar would come into the camp, not as somebody walking from the city. They probably did this to increase their chances of a friendly reception, right? These are just four guys coming in from the wilderness and not coming in from the city. But they did something, didn't they? They did something. And might I say, men and women, faith does something. Don't think that faith just keeps itself holed up in the prayer closet and keeps asking God to do something. Faith will do something. Faith will say, yes, Lord, I've prayed. I believe you've spoken to me. I'm going to step out and do something. Faith doesn't just stand back and say, God, you do everything, I'll do nothing. And I think one of the greatest examples of this is David in the battle against Goliath, right? Was David filled with faith before he went up against Goliath? Absolutely he was. So when he's there on the field of battle and Goliath's across from him and Goliath starts charging towards him, what does David do? Does David get down on his knees and say, oh Lord, now I pray that you'd smite Goliath? Send forth thine avenging angel and do the work there. No, what did David do? He ran right at him. Now, please don't tell me that David was not filled with faith. He had great faith, but he understood that faith did not exclude his action. And the lepers did that as well. They said, we are going to do something. They came into the Syrians' camp and they saw that nobody was there. Verse 6 tells us why. For the Lord had caused the army of the Syrians to hear the noise of chariots and the noise of horses, the noise of a great army. So they said to one another, look, the king of Israel has hired us against us, the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians, to attack us. Therefore they arose and fled at twilight and left the camp intact, their tents, their horses, their donkeys, and they fled for their lives. Now Israel was powerless against this besieging army. But God wasn't powerless. He attacked the Syrians just by causing them to hear the noise of a great army. Now, I don't know how God did this. Maybe God just put the noise into the air. But perhaps he just created the perception of the noise in the ears or in the minds of the Syrian soldiers. Well, I don't know how he did it. But the same God who struck one Syrian army so that they could not see, struck another Syrian army so they could hear things, or they did hear things that weren't actually there, and God sent the Syrians away. And might I say, this is another principle about faith. God answers faith far beyond expectation. These lepers perhaps hoped for a handout, right? They thought that they would walk up to the gate of the Syrian camp. Maybe we'll get a handout. Maybe we'll get a sword that will end it all. One way or the other, it's going to get resolved. They walked up there and they found so much more than they ever expected. It'd be like walking into a fully loaded grocery store and you can have everything you want. The camp was left, verse 7, intact. Everything was left behind, leaving the unlikely lepers to spoil the camp. Now I want you to understand something. Right now, at that moment, when the lepers walked in into their unbelieving eyes almost, I won't say unbelieving because they had faith, but to their disbelieving eyes, I should say, they said, it's all there for us. All the food, all the horses, all the donkeys, all the riches, it's all ours. I want you to understand, at that moment, the siege for Samaria was over. But no one in the city knew it. Not a single person knew it. The battle was finished, but they didn't know it. Only the lepers knew it. Everybody who went to bed that night felt that they were still locked in this horrible prison of a city where nothing could go in and nothing could go out. They felt that they were absolutely imprisoned, but they were actually as free as anything. And it was their ignorance of the fact that the battle had been won that kept them in bondage. So what happened? Verse 8. I love these verses. And when these lepers came to the outskirts of the camp, they went into one tent and ate and drank and carried from it silver and gold and clothing and went and hid them. And they came back and entered another tent and carried some from there also and went and hid it. What a time they were having. Don't you just see that? Then they said to one another, "We're not doing right. This day is a day of good news, and we remain silent. If we wait until morning light, some punishment will come upon us. Now therefore come, let us go tell the king's household." And so they went in and enjoyed the greatest meal. I bet they ate until their stomachs hurt. And then they let their stomachs feel a little bit better, and they ate some more. And the gold and the silver, and they laughed, and they enjoyed it. And they went and they hid it. They knew that their discovery of the camp would not remain a secret forever, so they hid some of the valuables of the camp so that they could profit of it even when the camp was discovered. But then in verse 9, their conscience gets a hold of them, doesn't it? It says, they said, "We're not doing right. Come, let us go tell." The lepers rightly enjoyed the miracle that God had provided. But they also realized that the gift gave them a responsibility to share it with other people. They understood that for them to remain silent, for them to just selfishly receive all of that bounty unto themselves and not open it up to others, that it would be a sin. Do you see what it says there in verse 9? That they had a responsibility to share the good news. Because it was good news. Listen, I hope we sense the same responsibility. Well, first of all, let me say this. Enjoy the feast yourself first. Go ahead. Don't be a guilty leper. You've come upon the camp. It's spoiled for you. Enjoy it. Enjoy it. But then realize, after you've received from the Lord, you have a solemn responsibility to pass it on to other people. I like what Charles Spurgeon said at this point. He said this: "If the only result of our religion is the comfort of our poor little souls, if the beginning and the end of piety is contained within oneself, why, it is a strange thing to be in connection with the unselfish Jesus and to have the fruit of his gracious spirit. Surely, Jesus did not come to save us that we might live unto ourselves. He came to save us from selfishness." Sometimes I think that's the most effective evangelistic appeal that we can give. Oh, and I mean not appeal to those who don't know the Lord. I mean the appeal to believers to go out and do evangelism. Don't be selfish. God's given you something wonderful. He's given you something marvelous. Why are you holding on to it and not spreading it out to other people? What do you think that its discovery is only for you? Do you think only you should be freed from that bondage and guilt and darkness of sin that's gripped your soul? Do you think you're the only one who should know the wonder and the beauty of glorifying God in your life? Do you think that you're the only one who should know how wonderful it is to know that you're a hand, excuse me, that you're a tool in the hand of the Creator and that He uses you? No, no, no. We want to give that out to everybody, don't we? And so did the lepers. So what happened? Verse 10. "So they went and called to the gatekeeper of the city and told them, saying, 'We went to the Syrian camp, and surprisingly, no one was there. Not a human sound, only horses and donkeys tied, and the tents were intact.'" And I think that's very interesting. You see, they knew that they had to communicate this to the king. But they didn't know anybody in the king's household, right? So they could have just given up. They could have just said, "Well, the king needs to know this, but we don't know the king, and we don't know anybody who knows the king. Oh, well, let's keep eating." No, they didn't do that. They said, "Listen, we have to tell somebody. And the one person that we can have contact with is the gatekeepers." So they walked up to the gates of the city of Samaritan. You can just see the food dripping off their faces. They walk up, they're wiping it off, right? Little belch right before they speak to the gatekeeper. gatekeeper's looking at him and says, why are you lepers speaking to me? He says, well, we've got a message of good news to deliver to you. And I guess I would say this. Listen, don't worry about saving the whole world. Save those that you have contact with right now. There it is, the gatekeeper. You can talk to the gatekeeper. There's somebody you can talk to. Maybe you can't talk to everybody, but of course you can. Stop fretting about saving the whole world. God's put people right in front of you that you can talk to. Make contact with them. Well, that's exactly what they did. Now coming on to verse 11, we read, and the gatekeepers called out, and they told it to the king's household inside. So the king arose in the night and said to his servants, let me now tell you what the Syrians have done to us. They know that we're hungry. Therefore, they've gone out of the camp to hide themselves in the field, saying, when they come out of the city, we shall catch them alive and get into the city. And one of his servants answered and said, please, let several men take five of the remaining horses which are left in the city. Look, they may either become like all the multitude of Israel that are left in it, or indeed, I say, they may become like all the multitude of Israel left from those who are consumed. So let us send them and see. So therefore, they took two chariots with horses, and the king sent them in the direction of the Syrian army, saying, go and see. And they went after them to the Jordan. And indeed, all the road was filled with garments and weapons, which the Syrians had thrown away in their haste. So the messengers returned and told the king. Isn't it beautiful? Just like the good news spreads. The gatekeepers told some people, they told other people, they told other people. Eventually, it reached the ears of the king, who received it with such marvelous faith, right? I think that's wonderful. He didn't remember a single thing that Elisha had told him the day before, right? Instead of saying, yes, Lord, you fulfilled your will, he goes, it's a trap, it's a trap. But they sent out guys to look wisely, and they went out to see. And then verse 16, then the people went out and plundered the tents of the Syrians. So a seah of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and two seahs of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. Now, when the good news that the lepers brought back was confirmed, when it was found to be true, there was no stopping the people, right? Because they knew their need. They were happy to receive God's provision to meet that need. No one could deny that it was true because the lepers experienced it. And then they themselves experienced. This is our testimony, isn't it? Now listen, Christianity is true quite apart from my experience of it, right? It's true because it's true. It's true because there's a God enthroned in heaven and his word is truth. And we never need, it's important that we never forget that. But at the same time, we're happy to add to it the testimony of our experience. To say, I have found it to be true in my life. And I hope you found it to be true in your life. And it's something that we can communicate to other people. I have tasted and seen, so can you. Now what about that king's officer who doubted? Shall we take a look at what happened to him? Verse 17. Now the king had appointed the officer on whose hand he leaned to have charge of the gate. But the people trampled him in the gate, and he died, just as the man of God had said, who spoke to the king when the king came down to him. So it happened as the man of God spoke unto the king, saying, two seahs of barley for a shekel, and a seah of fine flour for a shekel, shall be sold tomorrow about this time in the gate of Samaria. Then that officer had answered the man of God and said, now look, if the Lord would in fact make windows in heaven, could such a thing be? And he had said, in fact, you shall see it with your eyes, but you shall not eat of it. And so it happened to him, for the people trampled him in the gate, and he died. Friends, I think it's true. You can be in the midst of God's work. You can be in an environment where God is doing great and mighty things, and other people, so to speak, are eating at his feast, and you don't enjoy it. Why don't you enjoy it? Because of unbelief. And this, again, is what I would want to call to your mind, not as the only principle, but as perhaps one central principle for you to keep in mind in one of those seasons of siege battle in your life and in your ministry. Have faith. Trust in God. Regard enemy as an unbelief. Regard unbelief as something that will take away the blessing of God in your life, even when others are being blessed right in front of your face. You need to remember that. That God's church is going to do its work. That Jesus promised it so to us. Jesus promised that he would build his church and that the gates of hell would never prevail against it. But we need to stick with what God's doing, and we'll stick with his victory. Many years ago, me and my sons, we took a whitewater rafting trip. And as we were making our way down the river, our boat had several people. And in this boat, you had paddles. You were part of the crew, right? You were part of the engine. And the captain of our little boat was a Calvary Chapel pastor. His name is Joe Pratcher, Calvary Chapel Concord. And they do these great whitewater rafting trips, and we enjoyed it so much. All except for one thing. In our boat was a mom and her little son, and the mom was fine and all. I was there with my two sons, but the little boy was somewhat of a brat, if I could say. And if I could say, I don't mean to be too cruel to the little tyke. He was a little boy. But he's a bit of a coward as well. So when we were going down some falls and just hooting and hollering, yeah, this is great, paddle in, paddle backwards, do all that, just having a great time. Every time we came to the slightest bit of whitewater, this little boy would hit the deck, curl up in a fetal position, and just wait for it to be over. And we were just loving it, right? We were in the most wonderful time, and he endured it. By laying on the deck of the boat. Well, listen, I found it was interesting. We all got to the destination just fine. Even the young man who didn't seem to enjoy a bit of it. He was in the boat. He got to the destination. But those of us who took it by faith and enjoyed it, well, it was a much more pleasurable ride. Listen, you belong to God. You're part of his work in this world. I want you to have the enjoyment and the fruitfulness in your life that comes from faith. And if you're especially in a time of siege, where you wish you could have the open battle, but instead it's the drip, 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 day by day, you wonder how long the siege walls are going to be around you. My brother, my sister, I say to you, have faith. Regard unbelief as if it were an enemy, because it is. And trust in the promise that your God gives to you. Father, we can't do this apart from your strength. We need your strength, your work of the Spirit within us, so that we can live by faith.